Hello, welcome to Wadi Cherith, the podcast where we seek God's wisdom and inspiration in unexpected and ambiguous places. Today is the second part of our four-part review of Kenneth R. Miller's book, Finding Darwin's God. So let's go. Second time in 3 weeks, we will be reviewing our book, which is called Finding Darwin's God. I was going to say In Search of Darwin's God, like it was Star Trek, In Search of Spock. So today we'll be looking at chapters 3, 4, and 5 of that book, getting a little bit more into the meat of it. And I have joining me again Father Anthony Dill, our Hello. Resident. Are you finished?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's all right. Our resident expert in something?
Not really. I feel like I'm like the dub one struggling through this book so that people who don't really know science or theology can feel like they're a part of the conversation.
You're like the stand-in for people who don't
understand
it.
Yeah. I make it more accessible by muddling through my stupidity.
I'm trying to think of an example in literature of that character who is like the stand-in for just somebody like on the sidelines that doesn't like the choir in a Greek tragedy, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, wow.
That's probably not a great.
Yeah, choir in a Greek tragedy is kind of like a transitional piece and something that brings you home and like recaps.
Right. See, there you are. You're an expert in Greek theater.
Wow. I mean, I don't want to brag too much during this podcast, but we'll see if we do another podcast on Greek theater.
On Sophocles.
On Sophocles. Yeah. Probably not.
Probably not. I'm gonna go ahead and say probably not going to happen. So, I was kind of starting to hit home to me that I got a letter from the bishop the other day saying that I have to like respond in writing that my assignment's being changed. So it was kind of interesting to me because July 1st, so I'm going to stay until July 4th and 5th that weekend, but I think like July 1st, I'm no longer pastor.
All your powers are stripped.
All my powers are stripped. So I'm glad I'm getting all the confirmations in beforehand because I can't do those if I'm not pastor.
Yeah, you will not. They'll be invalid, but you can do them.
Oh, this week, or these last 2 weeks, I guess, we interviewed Rabbi Kaplan last week, which is a good one. This week, we read chapters 3, 4, and 5 of Finding Darwin's God, which really gets into the meat of the book, kind of talks about different particular objections to evolution and in a more theological context, I guess. Different ways that certain groups conceive of the whole thing happening. Is that a fair broad strokes analysis?
Yeah, he tries to put it into categories of which people that don't believe in evolution fall into.
Yeah. So it kind of works its way up. So the first kind of argument he tackles is it's a chapter entitled God the Charlatan, which would be like young earth creationists. So that's anybody who thinks not only is evolution wrong, but geological timescales are wrong. The earth is like 10,000 years old, that kind of thing. The same,
which I think they get is then. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
The second group is you're forgetting everything that we,
it's my idea.
This is your third podcast. You're forgetting so all the rules. It. The second group, it's entitled God the Magician. So that would be people that accept all the other basic scientific conclusions about the age of the earth, about geological timescales, but don't believe that macroevolution or evolution on a large scale from species to species happened. That it's difficult to really accept that one species could evolve into another species, which could evolve into another species. And then the third group that he discusses, it's called God the Mechanic. And he really narrows in on one thinker, but he is talking about people who agree with geological timescales, agree with the theory of evolution, but believe in this thing called irreducible complexity, that there has to be a different explanation for how complex things, specifically like the intricacies of the cell. But you could also be extended to things like the eye, like wings, or complex realities could have developed just through evolution, that there must be another explanation for them. So those are the three chapters that we covered today, and we're going to just talk about them one by one. So the first chapter was entitled God the Charlatan, and this is specifically talking about young Earth creationists, people who not only reject evolution, but who reject that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, who reject that different layers in rock formations are showing us different time periods, who reject our entire interpretation of the fossil record. Any impressions right off the bat of that first chapter, which was chapter 3?
Yeah, the younger Earth creationists, the year 10,000 comes from, I think, doing just adding up all the ages of everyone in the Bible back to Adam, and the idea that Adam was created on the literal day of Genesis, and so him plus a couple days is the age of the Earth. And it's all based off of a completely fundamentalistic and exact reading of the Bible, which as Catholics, we certainly don't demand that type of reading nor expect that type of reading of the Bible. But it comes from more of like an evangelical fundamentalist viewpoint. And so just like right off the bat, he's like, the nice thing about this group is they're not trying to take a scientific theory and then change a couple things, not realizing the effects of the change and saying, yeah, I believe in evolution, but they are completely rejecting scientific materialism and that has anything to do with reality, it seems. And they are just basing it like the Bible trumps everything no matter what, the fundamentalistic reading of the Bible. So I just want to get into like with when you were talking about the rock layers, I think it's hard to understand young Earth creationism if you this is, and this would be like the Creationism Museum in Kentucky follows this, right? And Ken Ham's a big author on this, and they basically just try to get you to think that any scientific facts we find are easily explainable by something else. So this is an example in the flood. They believe that the flood that happened with Noah, what's known as like the sixth chapter of Genesis, when that flood happened, that's what changed the different, geology and the layers of rocks, because when I think it was like all the animals were dying in this flood of Noah, the better swimmers could stay afloat longer and the worst swimmers couldn't. And so we have layers of fossils because the entire Earth was under a flood. And so they say, yeah, we see layers of fossils, but the only reason that exists is because different creatures died on different days based on their ability to swim.
Right. And then, which is why they would say that human beings, which as we all know, are the best swimmers in the entire natural world, or human ancestors are only found relatively recently in the fossil record because
better swimmers than fish.
Fish, for example. just a little background. I know like people like Ken Ham and a lot of people in this group tend to be pretty anti-Catholic in addition to being anti-evolution. So just want to throw that out there. That's not a blanket statement, but in a lot of cases that is true.
And there are Catholics who believe in young Earth creationism. It's a low percentage, but you can. I mean, I don't think we have an official you must believe in evolution.
No.
Or in intelligent design, or like no, we don't take an official stance on the scientific position.
Right. So a couple problems obviously he points out. Number one, if this were the case, you would expect the lowest layer in the rock formations to include basically all types of plant life, which, as we all know, can't swim. The problem is, obviously,
apparently we don't all know that.
Yeah, plants can't swim. So this is obviously not true, though. Not only is there plant life at upper levels of the fossil record, but there are certain types of plants, namely, he mentions flowering plants, which I believe originated in the Cretaceous or the Jurassic, or relatively recent. I mean, 100 some million years ago, but relatively recently, as far as the age of the Earth, if you accept that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, are not present in the lower levels. Now, an evolutionary biologist would say that's because they didn't exist yet, or a paleontologist or a paleobotanist, that they weren't around. That's why they're not in the fossil record. And I'm not sure there's a rock solid argument for why they'd be absent in those lower levels completely.
The other kind of like proof he uses, because again, if you would go to this creationism museum, you would see dinosaurs and humans living together, because everything had to happen everything had to be created in these 6 days before the day of rest. And he talks about fossilized feces, and that you would see in like old carnivorous animals, we have fossilized feces, you would see like certain things from different eras existing in the same feces, and there's not a single example that contradicts what we would expect given the fossil record.
Right. So you'd expect kind of animals from the Cambrian period with modern plants in their feces, which there simply is not. Or animals, dinosaurs with grasses in their feces, which of course there's not, because grasses were a more recent evolutionary development. But the big argument I think he makes, one of the big arguments he makes here that's pretty damning, is he says, it would be one thing if I thought this group was truly engaging in real scientific analysis. If they were serious about this as a scientific theory, then you would expect them just to be researching and combing the, for example, fossilized feces from all these different periods, trying to find contradictory evidence that supports their point that the Earth is 10,000 years old. But in fact, they're just not doing that type of research, which either indicates that they're not that interested in science at all, or that they have some idea that they're not going to find any evidence for their viewpoint.
That's exactly right. He just really is hammering them for being lazy. The next kind of thing it goes into after this idea of the different layers in the fossil record is he goes into paleomagnetism and just talks about the magnetic field of the Earth. And one of the critiques is that the magnetic field of the Earth has been gradually decreasing. And if you take the rate it's decreasing now, since we've been measuring it for, I think it was like the last 150 years, then the Earth couldn't be 10,000 years old. And he says, well, maybe that's a significant point. We'll have to look into that. And one of the lines I like is when he's talking to one of his teachers at Brown, the counter argument is, using the 150-year-old decrease in the field strength to argue for an Earth of 10,000 years makes about as much sense as watching the tide rise by a foot over 3 hours and concluding that the Earth could not be more than 9 years old. Because we're taking like such small snippets of data and then making giant conclusions of them. And he starts to talk about, from that point, that the rocks themselves have a magnetic field at their creation. And then he starts to get into radioisotopes and carbon dating. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Go ahead.
Thank you. Just a definition, he starts out and he talks about carbon dating is based off of the way half-life works with the radioactive isotope. So the one he starts with is uranium, and it's 235U. And the well-known radioactive, I'm quoting now from page 66, the well-known radioactive isotope decays through a series of intermediates to an isotope of lead known as 207 Pb. The half-life of the series is 713 million years, which means that after that length of time, one half of the 235U in a sample will have decayed into 207 PB. Half-life is, it's an unstable material, and they know that after whatever the half-life is, half of the material has decayed into something that's more stable. And they do this with a ton of different isotopes. So it's not just one thing that we're reading dates off of. There's a bunch of different, he actually lists every single radioisotope that exists on Earth and also that exists, period. And he talks about different ways that they take this type of dating and cross-reference it with other materials and find the same date over and over again. And the one that he gets the most like proof from is they can take multiple points from the same mineral. And it's a rubidium strontium method. And it's the way they can take multiple pieces from the same material and basically graph how two different materials break down, the ratio of 87 SR to 86 SR versus the ratio of 87 RB to 86 SR. And it forms something called an isochron, which shows that all the different samples are showing the same level of decay or half-life and showing the exact same age, even though they're testing it multiple different ways at the same time. He's just saying, like, it's not like we're guessing here, or it's like we took one and we got this result. It's every single thing that we're testing is showing us that, like, the same mineral is the same age from where we got it.
Captivating.
Well, I know it's a little like technical, but it is, like, I think it's super important because he's trying to say the Earth, it's not like God created the Earth. He kind of concludes with saying God didn't create the Earth to just be old 10,000 years ago. He created it to look like it was already 4 billion years old when Adam and Eve were in the garden. So you had aged trees and grown up grass and overgrown shrubs and all these different things that existed with all the signature that shows that the Earth was 4.5 billion years old. So that Adam and Eve, for some reason, could live in a garden that looked like it was 4.5 billion years old and had all these signs of 4.5 billion years old, which comes from the, there's all these ways to measure that age. And so the conclusion for the young Earth creationism is God has to be deceptive. He created all these ways to measure that length of time. And if you believe that that's who God is, then you believe in a deceiving God, which is not really compatible with a Christian God.
And that's really, I think, the big theological, in addition to the scientific arguments against this viewpoint, that's a theological argument that's going to come up again and again, this idea that that this theory in particular would necessitate that God is trying to make us think that the Earth is older than it is, which is problematic because we don't believe in a deceptive God. But it's also problematic when you think of somebody like Thomas Aquinas, who believes, and not just Aquinas, but any of our theologians, who believe that we can trust that God created a world for us to understand, and we can trust what our senses are teaching us, that God wants us to be able to have a trust in the things that we learn. And if here we're positing a God that has created things to look one way when the reality is different, then that calls into question our ability to understand the world around us at all, which is a theological point. So the next chapter is entitled God the Charlatan and
God the Magician.
I'm sorry, that was the last one, right? God the Magician, which is a viewpoint that we want to accept that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, that the geological record is accurate, and even that these different species existed in different times, but it's questioning the ability for evolution to produce a completely new species, that we only have evidence of microevolution, of like a bird's beak kind of changing its shape slightly, which is one of Darwin's examples, that's possible. We can see that, but we don't really have any evidence that that a species can completely evolve into a different species over time.
And the kind of within this, he starts with kind of a revolutionary book and pretty famous scientists who challenge the complete role of Darwinian evolution and propose these species changes that are more abrupt. And that kind of idea within the scientific community that's novel and interesting gets stolen by a bunch of non-scientific people, basically to get back on board with God has to exist. I know you said you might want to talk about Stephen Gould a little bit. Do you want to?
Yeah. So I really like Stephen Jay Gould, actually. He writes detailed scientific works in a way that's really interesting. And I think Miller even points out, or was it Miller? Or was maybe I read it somewhere else that Stephen Jay Gould can talk about like changes in worm species and like make a non-scientist want to read about it. But Stephen Jay Gould, I think for a lot of religious people has been an important scientist. Stephen Jay Gould is the one that coined the term, you've probably heard of it, non-overlapping magisteria. So Stephen Jay Gould is a prominent, he's no longer alive, but was a prominent scientist who, one of his ideas was that there's no real conflict between science and religion because they're talking about different things. So they don't overlap. Science is talking about the natural processes by which things happen. And religion is talking about ultimate meaning, morality, metaphysics. And he's saying they don't conflict because they're talking about different things. This is this idea of non-overlapping magisteria. Any thoughts on that theory, which maybe you haven't heard that wording, but I'm sure you've heard that before.
I have some thoughts on that, but I think it's not something I'm going to get into quickly.
Can I get into it a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I like that. I think that's generally speaking true. And it works both ways, right? Just like people like, you know, Ken Ham shouldn't look at the Bible as a science textbook. The scientific community really shouldn't be describing ultimate meaning or you know, the sources of morality, things like someone like Richard Dawkins tries to do, that's science overstepping his bounds. So that distinction cuts both ways. One of the things that one of my favorite scientists, Guy Consolmano, who's a Jesuit brother, runs the Vatican Observatory, in his kind of tweaking of Gould's idea of non-overlapping magisteria, says that's true mostly, but we also have to understand that human beings are scientists. We're in search of information. We're trying to understand the world around us. And human beings are also religious. We're interested in morality, deeper meaning, the source of all things. And so they do overlap in the sense that a scientist has religious beliefs and a scientist has religious values that motivate him. So we're not all machines. We don't have like science machines and religion machines. We're human beings. And we're influenced by a variety of factors and information and stimuli. And so we can't necessarily neatly separate the two all the time. You know, we are flawed, biased, you know, products of our environments. And so that's where the two overlap a little bit. And I think that's a valid point.
That is a valid point. All right, I'm going to get us into Gould and Eldridge's theory that like kind of
gets all right, we're already at 26 going. Minutes, so don't get too in-depth.
All right, and you can so they wrote this theory called punctuated equilibrium, and it basically is Darwinian is gradual change over time, whereas punctuated equilibrium is like it's static for a while, and then all of a sudden a new species pops into create existence, which is why it's called God and the Magician. This was a novel and like kind of accepted theory, but Miller writes that the problem, or basically when people read this, they heard that evolution doesn't necessarily have the assumption that it's true anymore or is mainline science, and that there's gaps in the fossil record, and that we don't have to believe in macro evolution. And so people started running with that.
Right. And one of the things that I think Gould is really trying to do is to say that it's not like there's this consistent, constant evolution from one species to the next, but that certain events, certain instances kind of spur immediate changes. And one thing we do know from the fossil record is that after a mass extinction, right, like when the dinosaurs go extinct, you have this upsurge of kind of crazy and strange species show up, and some of them don't last that long. But like, it kind of happens in fits and spurts a little bit, I think is really what Gould's trying to say, which isn't, as Miller says, necessarily inconsistent with a theory of evolution.
And he just talks about like certain, because the attack is kind of there's gaps in the fossil record, or there's gaps in where we can see these different creatures are crossing over, or species are crossing over from species to species. So he gives a couple examples of that. And then he also says, when it's like taken into like an extreme Christian interpretation about God being this intelligent designer, and so each new species is brought into existence by God as something new, which is why it's not random evolution, because God's consciously bringing each species new with these jumps, these punctuations. He attacks that, I think, with kind of a interesting quote. He says, I'm on 102, careful studies of the mammalian fossil record show that the average length of time a species survives after its first appearance is around 2 million years. 2 million years of existence and then extinction. The story is similar for insects. Average species duration, 3.6 million years. And for marine invertebrate, average duration, 3.4 million years. In simple terms, the designer just can't get it right the first time. Nothing he designs is able to make it over the long term.
Yeah, and I think that gets at the real theological argument against this, is that that viewpoint just seems like an unnecessarily clumsy and inelegant way to create a universe.
And for us to feel like we need to attribute something to God specifically, like we understand how God works or what God's doing. And
right. So one of the a theological concept is this idea of proximate causes, you know, that we don't necessarily need to attribute each thing that happens in the universe directly to God with no other explanation.
And certainly God is involved in way, way more events than this. I mean, God's involved in every single instant of everything existing always. So this is even like a limitation of God. Like God's just showing up when new species are being created or something like that. It's like a weird way to visualize, oh, now God's stepping in, I think.
Yeah. So are we good with that chapter?
I want to do one more thing. I'm sorry, but the mechanism thing I thought was a pretty important thing, and because it's talking about how we go from microevolution to macroevolution. And we talked about this a little bit on our last one as well, but we talked about it with, I think, HIV and how HIV adapts and copies. And he goes into it even more detail with E. coli, and he talks about can be as often as every 30 seconds that it divides. And or every 30 minutes, I'm sorry. E. coli divides every 30 minutes, and the entire genome must be copied, and the two copies carefully separated so that each daughter cell receives an identical set of genes. Sometimes this happens perfectly, but sometimes little mistakes are made, and one or two of the nucleotides are miscopied. Sometimes the mistakes are more serious, and parts of the genome don't get copied at all, while other parts get copied twice. Sometimes genes will be duplicated, moved from one place to another, or turned completely around. These alterations are known as mutations. And I really like how much he emphasizes mutation in this, because I think there's a misunderstanding of how frequently, again, these genes are being copied and slightly changed, and how much potential energy is there for things to be adapting. Every 30 minutes, this is happening and copying. So quickly an organism can change, or the proteins can change, and little adaptations can be made and kept if they're useful.
Right. So then we move into chapter 6, which is God the Mechanic, which is this view that, okay, we'll accept geological timescales. We'll accept even evolution from species to species. But the problem is, and he uses a biochemist, I think, from Lehigh University, who says, but there's some things that are just too complicated to be the product of evolution. It's this idea of irreducible complexity. So this is kind of an old idea, but the classic examples are things like an eye or a wing, that they're just too complicated to be the product of evolution. And the famous saying is that half a wing or half an eye does you no good. So how do we get to that level of complexity? And the irreducible complexity argument would say there had to be some design from the beginning. These things couldn't just have arisen.
And this is based off a 1996 book called Darwin's Black Box. And the black box is the cell. So he primarily starts with cell biology. And yeah, you're right. The idea is there's all these complex functions in the cell, and to only have like three or four or five or six of them working at once doesn't give it an advantage regarding natural selection. So why? Okay, granted, these mutations can happen. These mutations are happening. But why would something that has half an eye that can't see survive? If we're talking about mutations are one thing, natural selection is another thing. Natural selection picks the mutations that are good. Half a wing doesn't get you to fly. So why would it survive in this Darwinian evolution?
Right. So I think there's a couple arguments against this that he goes into. One thing that strikes me is there is this thing called convergent evolution. So wings have kind of showed up multiple times, and kind of in different ways and for different reasons. So, you know, in mammals, for instance, you can see rodents like flying squirrels who use wings not to fly necessarily, but kind of to more softly get from one branch to another. So you can kind of understand how just an extra flap of skin could have become more and more advantageous the bigger it was. And eventually you get to something like a wing. In birds, birds are very closely linked to dinosaurs on the evolutionary tree. And there's a lot of fossil evidence that's relatively recent that wings in dinosaurs didn't originally develop for flight. But, as you may know, a lot of dinosaurs are bipedal, meaning they walked on two legs. And they used, things like raptors. Think about a raptor, which would use its hind legs to pin its prey down. And there's a thought that wings kind of developed to like stabilize a little bit as it was attacking, because its lower legs were used to pin the animal down and needed something to stay standing upright. And so that kind of developed slowly and turned into a wing, which could be used for flight. Or things like feathers may have originally been to attract mates or to scare off competitors. And kind of, so there are pieces of evidence in the fossil record for half a wing having a use, actually. Maybe not flight, but it started off as something else.
And he also talks about like there's two different, yeah, exactly like you're saying, it could be for the same use over and over again. It could be flight the whole time and it just gets better and better flying, or it could be a totally different use. He does the example with the Krebs cycle in 151, which is a good one. He talks about an eye, like first they could have light sensory and then a little more light sensory, and that's always an advantage to have more light sensory if you have light in your environment. So it's always the same function for sight. But then he talks about the Krebs cycle, which is for digestion, is some of the proteins are doing something and it steals those, and it takes proteins from something else and steals those. And it slowly starts misusing and like tinkering basically with all the tools it has in the toolbox from different proteins that exist within the system already.
So this gets into, and I think I'd like to, as we close, I think it's a relevant theological thing to talk about. I think this really gets into something that's a problem, not just with evolution, but it's a discussion we have to have about things like free will or just understanding the world around us, natural disasters. Like, how do you reconcile God being omniscient, knowing everything that's going to happen, and God's providence, that God has a plan for his creation, with kind of these little individual seemingly random or determined by free will actions. You know, like, how do you reconcile an all-knowing God with the destruction caused by a virus, or with humans choosing to turn away from God, or with kind of the random selection that takes place through evolution? Like, what's the relationship between a universe that seems to kind of keep churning and working and kind of having either random or bad things happen with a God that also knows everything that's going to happen? I don't think that's just a problem for understanding evolution theologically. I think it's a bigger question about just how we see the world in general.
I agree. It's an excellent question regarding how much control we have, how much control God has, and what actually matters. Like, if everything is just going to keep working out anyways. I would like to think about that question and dive into it next week, because it's a huge question.
It is. But I think it really gets into the complexities of the whole thing. Like, it's not so simple as saying, if you believe that something could have arisen through evolution, you're denying God's presence. Or like,
yeah,
or that absolutely. You have to think that God, like, kind of like stuck his hands in here and manipulated his creation, or constantly is doing so. Like, there's got to be some nuance in understanding a universe that's understandable and has processes that are explainable and traceable, and also a God who is involved in each step of the way and who's upholding it in existence. That's a nuanced concept, and to just reduce it to some of these theories on evolution and intelligent design, I don't think is doing service to our God and the way our God is active in his creation.
Also, just the viewpoint of death, and like, we're using, like, it's a cold term, natural selection, but the fact that God lets whatever over 99% of his creation die or become extinct, or things die all the time, or things fail, or things have a mutation and it's good or it's bad. Like, what does that mean? Like, maybe even in scripture itself, like, so many people die when the Israelites come back into the Holy Land. And what does it mean that things are dying, and the quality of that, of being bad or good, the moral quality.
Right. Cheery note to end on. but we are at 40 minutes now, and I think we've talked about it a little bit. Of course, if you're reading the book, you can look at it more, and we'll dive into some of these questions and more next week as we discuss chapters 6 and 7 of Kenneth Miller's Finding Darwin's God. So thank you, Father Anthony Dill, for joining us again.
Thank you, Father. Love being on the show.
And we'll see you next week to discuss the next part of the book. Thank you. Stay safe and God bless. And we'll see you next week to discuss the next part of the book.